Direct Relief is a nonprofit medical material aid organization. So we receive medical supplies and pharmaceuticals and distribute them on a charitable basis to local healthcare providers around the world and in the United States. We work in all 50 states and 70 countries around the world. We don't maintain our own sort of field programs in the kind of a conventional model. We maintain a supply chain that goes out to local providers. And a lot of that work gets done during disaster response. So the folks that we tend to work with on a normal basis also tend to be located in areas where they're subject to high frequency of extreme events. So, and Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines is a good example of that, actually. We work on being able to target aid effectively and move it quickly and efficiently. That's
both domestically and internationally.
When do we get started? Huh? So I think they have. I think we have to go in the order that they have us listed in the session. So, so my name is Andrew Schroeder. I'm the director of research analysis for Direct Relief, and I just gave you the rundown really quickly on Direct Relief. And I'm going to talk about a little bit of work that we did on a kind of experimental basis during the response to Typhoon Haiyan / Yolanda in the Philippines, specifically around health facility assessment and disease surveillance. So just to kind of rewind back to November of last year, Typhoon Haiyan was the largest storm ever to make landfall in recorded history. 6,000 dead officially, although, you know, when you talk to people throughout the affected area, there's a broad-based assumption that the official numbers are off by at least 50%, if not much more. There was a number of reasons for that. A highly politicized aid situation relative to the national government and regulations around how aid gets distributed. So the numbers of recorded dead as they were distributed around the affected area and wounded were hard to rely on very effectively. So Direct Relief's interest and response to the typhoon is to target assistance to medical programs that are working in the relief area. Usually we target health infrastructure, so we have a sort of overriding interest in trying to understand how health infrastructure is affected by the event. We work with a broader array of organizations during disaster, so we can target assistance to any number of programs that emerge very specifically for the disaster response as well. And our goal, as much as it's possible in a highly chaotic emergency situation, is to be very specific about how medical assistance gets targeted and distributed. So we're looking for a scale of need for humanitarian medical assistance. We're looking for location, concentration, prioritization of need. We're looking at the conditions of the infrastructure and the supply channels for key medical commodities that can address problems that are arising as a result of the events. We're looking at change over time. So medical response after an emergency changes fairly dramatically over time. When the event first happens in an acute phase, in the first 24, 48 hours up through the first 2-3 weeks, say, the primary needs are for establishment of emergency shelter, food and nutrition, triage of traumatic injury, the certain concerns over emergence of waterborne illness. And as you move out into sort of subsequent phases, you see a much broader array of problems that emerge from exposure, long-term dislocation from medical infrastructure, people that have chronic conditions that are not able to receive care for those chronic conditions because of the impact on medical infrastructure. And so we see also an interconnection, obviously. This seems self-evident, but it's often difficult to analyze in a disaster response about the relationship between factors emerging in the health system and factors emerging through a number of other areas of the response. So high impact on, say, water systems also impacts on the occurrence of waterborne illness, and that's differentially played out throughout the disaster zone, since assistance is actually differentially played out through the disaster zone. So we've been trying to work on a number of different ways. It's difficult for NGOs often to get our heads around that set of problems. It's actually a very broad-based set of issues that requires, really, to get a good handle on it, collaboration across many different organizations. No one organization is really honestly able to put the pieces together to properly surveil the situation and turn that surveillance into rapidly actionable information that can drive assistance. So if we want to get to the point where assistance is being driven towards areas of highest need and not towards areas which are driven politically, or areas that are just easy to get to, areas that are driven by media attention, then we need to sort of think through a broader set of issues around data collaboration for the sake of assistance. So one of the things that we've been doing is collaborating with a data analysis firm based in Palo Alto called Palantir. Palantir was invented in the early 2000s. It was an offshoot of PayPal. So PayPal is a payment system, as you probably mostly know from shopping on the internet. But that really wasn't the sort of key insight of PayPal when it first started. The key insight of PayPal was that it was an anti-fraud system. So they sort of think about their main issue was how to secure payments and how to be able to guarantee that money would arrive safely. So they developed a set of data mining tools to be able to solve a set of needle in haystack problems, basically. So where are people seeing anomalous transactions, and where are you most likely to have risk of fraud of some kind, and then you could intervene in the financial system. So this was repurposed into counterterrorism for quite a long time. It was used for being...
And then it ends up in the April. That's great.
So yeah, for quite a long time, this was actually off limits to everybody other than people that are working in counterterrorism. I think probably around 2009-2010, as you know, a number of the dynamics were changing with their core business, they started a philanthropy program, and we were one of the groups to begin using the software for a different problem set than what it was intended for, what it had been used for. Really, what Palantir does is it allows for large-scale data integration across essentially unlimited array of formats through what they call a dynamic ontology. So a dynamic ontology is, an ontology is just a set of categories for organizing things, and a dynamic ontology means that it can be revised really rapidly as your understanding and needs shift in terms of the integration. And this allows for pulling together any format of data and to look for sort of cross-references, correlations across those large-scale data integrations. In the context of the Philippines, they were doing a set of projects with us and then with the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs to solve information and analytic bottlenecks in the emergency response of different but related kinds. So what you're looking at here is a dashboard, actually, that emerges from a integration of all of the data that was reported to UN OCHA and the NDRMC, which is the Philippine government's National Disaster response and recovery program. So they have different databases, very different formats. They track programs in somewhat different ways. These were harmonized through the ontology into aid sectors, rendered common in terms of the UN cluster hierarchies, and then put into a framework where we could look fairly easily at numbers of projects across sector, how those projects were proceeding towards reported completion, and numbers of beneficiaries as reported through the system. It has the drawback that this is all self-reported information by aid programs, so it's only as accurate as the reporting of it is. But by pulling it together into a common framework, you can at least see, according to what the aid world is actually saying about their activities, how those activities are related to one another on a cross-sectoral basis. What we did to supplement that was to look at how would we get out in the field and do a set of assessments of health facility infrastructure. In the Philippines, the administrative system, the lowest level of the administrative system is called a barangay. Barangay is essentially a unit that's about the size of a census block, about 4,000, 5,000 people on average. There's 43,000 of them spread across the country, and each one of them by policy is supposed to have a health station. So the health stations, which are most likely to serve the interests of the people that live in that barangay, well, of course there's a wide variety of other health infrastructure, but the ones that particularly for remote areas where healthcare is scarce are going to be the barangay health stations. These turn out to be very difficult to actually access, particularly during an emergency where you're experiencing severe transportation disruptions. It's very difficult to, there's no established electronic reporting system, for instance, that comes out of the barangay health stations, and often they were in areas which were just hard to reach for a number of different reasons. You can see there we sort of went through two different periods of assessment, and this tracks to the area of the storm. So the storm came through the central part of the Philippines, through the Visayas, and up through Panay Island, which is this big one up here. I'm sorry. First set of assessments was done by a group that we worked with in Hurricane Sandy, a group called Team Rubicon, which is a group of U.S. military veterans who volunteer in emergency response situations and put they're used to working in austere environments. Many of them have a wide variety of skills, from being able to set up shelter to doing data collection analysis. The system that we used for through Palantir Mobile was a way to link form-based data collection to the integration that had been done previously. So the integration that from earlier, the OCHA information linked to NDRMC that was showing the scope of aid projects around the affected area, is linked into the form-based data collection and is live updated as you work. In Hurricane Sandy, this was possible because the cellular infrastructure actually was not completely knocked out. So it requires some form of internet connection in order to be able to achieve real-time understanding of how teams are moving. The term they apply to this is actually derives again from a weird military term called blue force tracking, which is where you see in real time actors as they move in a space where they're attempting to accomplish something. So we were working with Rubicon and then had worked with a number of other groups that were doing different things in the same area, and so our interest was in trying to see across different groups that were you know, in within different administrative structures and different had different goals, how they were all interacting within the same space. And health facility assessment is part of that. The second group was the Philippines Red Cross, which also had a long-term interest in being able to support local health infrastructure. And so we worked with them to bring their assessment system online and to attempt to speed up the process of turning the assessments into actionable information. So connectivity is really one of the key technological problems in the assessment process here. So like I said, during Hurricane Sandy, we were okay given that we could set up that kind of integrated mobile ontology through the use of the GSM network. In Typhoon Haiyan, we didn't have that luxury, so this was the experimental part of the whole thing. We used a device called an InReach SE, which is produced by this company called Delorme, which is based in Maine. It's usually used, it's a satellite-connected SMS messaging device. So it's a GPS, and you can send short messages of 160 characters through the device. It connects to the Iridium satellite network and allows for you to remain communicating in remote environments. It's mostly used, actually, by mountain climbers or people that are on a boat somewhere that want to be able to have redundant communications, even though they're not necessarily connected to a network. In there's an obvious need for this in disaster response, but the short communication, the short codes are difficult to work with in terms of structured data collection. So we devised a system to take a structured data collection form, essentially looking at a basic set of properties, which you probably saw on the sidebar in the previous slide, around the damage level to the facility, key needs, number of patients that were being seen at the facility, and number of patients estimated going forward, transformed those into a short code separated by an identifier that allows you to parse the fields, transmit the form through 160 character strings, and then parse them in on the back end into full-blown information objects. So you could use the InReach SE as a form-based data collection system. Difficult to use still, though. So I would say, again, this is again a kind of experiment. The main thing that that was valuable about it was being able to remain connected and to be able to get rapid identification of the location and condition of health facilities. The parsing process as a on the front end, the entry of that information turned out to be very cumbersome, actually. There's a few tricks that I can go that we discovered over the time, but those tricks never took the pain away of being able to actually enter information easily into this kind of format. What we, through that process, we discovered, say 40% of the facilities that we were encountering were severely damaged. The ones that were severely damaged were continuing to see patients on a regular basis. We were able to establish a number of priorities around the needs for supplies for treating traumatic illness, traumatic injury, and a range of illnesses. And when we began doing this, we were approached by a number of other groups that were interested in seeing how this sort of remote satellite-based data collection system could be applied to a broader range of disease surveillance activities. Within the Philippines, there's a standard syndromic emergency reporting system. I believe it's the only country that this has actually been rolled out to, although there's, I think, now an interest in a number of other countries in seeing about how the system could be applied to their own emergency disease surveillance activities. It's called the SPEED system, which stands for Surveillance in Post-Extreme Emergencies and Disasters. And they track 21 identifiable diseases, 15 communicable, 6 non-communicable. It relates directly to the facility-based reporting system that's already in place. So it's not asking facilities to report on things that they aren't normally tracking. And it's a syndromic surveillance system, which means that they're not confirming the diagnosis, they're actually reporting on suspected cases. But the goal is to, like the title indicates, is to speed up the process. So it's designed to for hypothesis formation and for guiding rapid assistance to affected areas. Their goal is to make this a fully digital system with redundant communications built into the system, but of course that doesn't really work right now. And clearly during Typhoon Haiyan, it did not yet exist. There's a lot of work that's gone on since Typhoon Haiyan to improve the system and make it more, digitally... It's online, it's digitally connected, and to make at least a portion of that able to survive the outage of the cell phone system. I worked in this case with the health cluster in Tacloban City. So Tacloban, it was the most affected area in the typhoon. It's the city in the Eastern Visayas that was right on the edge of the point of the storm. 95% of all the structures in the city were destroyed or severely damaged, and by unofficial count, they probably had as many deaths as the entire official count for the country. The mayor's office, Tacloban is actually like its own it's like a city-state, actually. And there were a number of political issues between the mayor of Tacloban City, who comes from a different party than the president of the country. So because of those political divisions, they actually set up their own cluster system inside Tacloban that was not... So the, for those that aren't aware, maybe the cluster systems are United Nations tools for linking together actors in a particular sector that are working in an emergency response situation. There was a central cluster system that was set up by the UN for the entire area, but Tacloban set up its own and ran it through the mayor's office. And was, in the health case, supported by the World Health Organization as they attempted to get their disease surveillance system online. And this was very hard for them to do. They had a set of paper forms that they were going out to the hospitals and clinics in the affected area, and these were... these were based on the speed reporting system, and when I met the head of the cluster... a doctor named Gloria Fabregas, she was, you know, very distraught about the time lag in their system. So they would get information and essentially have to wait a week for it to be collated and pulled from the forms that they were collecting. And so often they would actually get information that they needed to act upon within 24 hours about conditions like measles. It's a dengue endemic area. There's a disease that's transmitted through rats and water in the area that often is associated with waterborne conditions. And so she was trying to figure out a way to speed this process up by putting it into some sort of online form. So we linked up their report, their case reporting system, to the InReach device and began rolling it out to participating health facilities. I wouldn't say that we got a lot of participation in it, actually. This was a difficult thing to work on administratively, it turns out, that there was very little requirement on facilities to comply with the system. And so we only had 3 facilities through the area that actually reported regularly through the satellite-connected system that we linked up. Others kept reporting through paper forms. They were just more comfortable with it, and the health cluster put those together. You know, one of the things that became really interesting, as this is showing daily occurrence of animal bites in the facilities that were being treated. The bulk of them are reporting none, but a number of these are in over five population. The animal bites were reported in some cases as many as 70, 80, 90 a day, actually. So, and this was distributed throughout the whole area that we were looking at. You know, when you go back to the baseline information, actually on a good day in these areas, there is a reasonable occurrence of animal bites, but when we sort of sat down with the cluster and started talking through the system and showed out the information about frequency of animal bites that were being treated at the facilities, there was a sort of interesting cross-sectoral conclusion about the role that the shelter limitations were playing. So at the time we were doing this, this is in the sort of second wave of health facilities assessments that you saw from an earlier slide in January and February. And by this time, a number of people had actually been were living in temporary shelters for a fairly extensive period. And so they were coming into contact with essentially roaming dogs on a regular basis, and this became sort of recognized as one of the sort of key issues around linking the shelter section with the health section, where you know, to some degree that is a medical problem. There's a potential for rabies transmission, there's a wound care required, there was stress on the supplies they had available for disinfection and for treatment of the bites, not let alone vaccination for rabies. But you know, of course, this is also a symptom, an indicator of the shelter system, and became part of a broader discussion about the need for transitioning people from temporary to more permanent shelters to be able to control for that. So, you know, I think that one of the things that you know, we learned through that process is the need to really think in these integrated in integrated cross-sectoral ways to try to act rapidly in response so that problems can be identified, hypotheses can be formed, and we can follow up target assistance much more effectively. I would say that it's probably number one rule is try not to test new technologies during disaster response events. I'm glad that we actually did this. In retrospect, I think that it's something where the value of experimentation is in identifying possibilities and pathways going forward. Expecting it to work properly during the crisis is, I think, more than you can really reasonably hope for. So, you know, I think that it calls attention to the need for a sort of more broad-based preparedness infrastructure that I'll talk about just really quickly in a second. And that involves a combination of the ontology for being able to understand integrated activity, technologies that can enable rapid connection, and the partnerships that are able to actually both do that data collection and make use of it in a rapid, actionable way. So where we're going now is to transition this over into what I would call data preparedness. We've been working with a range of groups in the Philippines, continuing with the health cluster as they're looking at being able to both integrate their what's called the PIDSR, their normal disease surveillance system, with preparedness for speed reporting, to link that into a framework beforehand so that they're online and that we have the forms built before events, but then also linked up with a range of Philippine NGOs. This is the footprint of the organization Gawad Kalinga, which is a Philippine shelter NGO that builds communities for people living at $2 a day or less. Gawad Kalinga you know, has not been traditionally involved in health surveillance at all. They're a shelter organization, but as we sort of worked with them in the context of the health cluster in Tacloban and elsewhere, we discovered that they were actually picking up all kinds of signals about the needs of their communities that were not being shared with any of the United Nations infrastructure and were not really seen as part of the conventional health surveillance system, given that they were actually working in shelter. And so if we can, I think, set up routines based on what we've sort of already worked with in the Philippines so that there's a system in place to pick up, say, the need for treatment for various conditions, the linkage between these communities and the barangay health centers. So each one of these is proximate to a health center, and we have a survey system in place now to run those assessments beforehand, and then to put technology in place with key regional leaders that are linked with the communities that we're working with. You know, ideally, this can actually turn into a much more resilient system that can look across a number of these different conditions and be ready at the point where we actually need to have these in place and not have us inventing systems for surveillance in the middle of the worst day ever.